So I think there's a profound connection between revelry and play. And that's kind of what I'm doing here. Now, this for me is a little bit of play, a little less serious kind of a service. There's a connection between revelry and play. And play is something quite profound. Dr. Stuart Brown has done more to help us to understand the importance of play than anyone else has. It's a universal experience amongst animals, and it's fundamentally extremely important in their development. Here's a video clip of Dr. Stuart Brown describing a dramatic example of play in the animal kingdom.
So I'm going to take you through what I think is a remarkable sequence. North of Churchill, Manitoba, in October and November, there's no ice on Hudson Bay, and this polar bear that you see is 1,200-pound male. He's wild and fairly hungry. And Norbert Rossing, a German photographer, is there on scene making a series of photos of the husky to her tent. And from out of stage left comes this wild male polar bear with a predatory gaze. Any of you have been to Africa or had a junkyard dog come after you, there is a fixed kind of predatory gaze that you know you're in trouble. But on the other side of that predatory gaze is a female husky in a play bow wagging her tail. And something very unusual happens. That fixed behavior, which is rigid and stereotyped and ends up with a meal, changes. And this polar bear stands over the husky, no claws extended, no fangs, taking a look, and they begin an incredible ballet. A play ballet. This is in nature. It overrides the carnivorous nature and what otherwise would have been a short fight to the death. And if you begin to look closely at the husky that's burying her throat to the polar bear, and look a little more closely, they're in an altered state. They're in a state of play. And it's that state that allows these two creatures to explore the possible. They are beginning to do something that neither would have done without the play signals. And it is a marvelous example of how different in power can be overridden by a process of nature that's within all of us.
So Dr. Brown's study of play has led him to make the connection between some of the worst examples of violent antisocial behavior and the deprivation or the lack of meaningful play in the life of the child who grew up to be the perpetrator. The importance of play will be the subject of next week's sermon, so I won't go into it too deeply here. But play is often considered to be the realm of children. And perhaps revelry then can be seen as play for adults. Neoteny is a word that's N-E-O-T-E-N-Y. Came across for the first time. Is a word that describes the retention of childlike characteristics into adulthood. Neoteny is usually used in a pejorative sense. The retention of childlike attributes is often seen as inappropriate for adults. But in the case of play, Dr. Brown argues convincingly that the retention of our ability to play into adulthood is critical to good mental health and to continued emotional and spiritual growth. So what authority does a minister like me have to be preaching about play and revelry? Actually, revelry and play are the subject of a great amount of theological debate and discussion. Our Unitarian Universalist forebears had to fight to develop and defend a theology that could embrace revelry. Our faith tradition sprang from Puritan roots. And for the Puritans and the Calvinists and virtually all early Protestant denominations, the world was seen as broken, as a place of misery, a place of pain, a place of toil, and a place of struggle. For our forebears, the role of religion was to help us to survive in this broken world. to bear the consequences of original sin, and to transcend it through sacrifice and confession and an industrious work ethic. Anything approaching revelry was reserved for a time far off. I haven't granted to those who had earned it. The stage was set for Christianity back in the time of St. Paul of Tarsus in the 1st century and St. Augustine of Hippo in the 4th century. Paul in Romans 7 wrote, "I can will what is right, but I cannot do it. I delight in the law of God in my inmost self, but I see in my members another law, at war with the law of my mind, making me captive to the law of sin that dwells in my members. Wretched man that I am, who will rescue me from this body of death?" St. Augustine is arguably the most influential of the early Christian thinkers, and he famously wrote his Confessions where he renounced his earlier life of earthly pleasures for a pure pursuit of the love of God. St. Augustine left us this amazing writing, his Confessions, where he described his conversion from someone who found joy in the world and the world's pleasures to someone who found joy exclusively in the love of God. In the early phase, he is quoted as having said, "Give me chastity and continence, but not yet." Elaine Pagels is critical of Augustine's equation of sex and original sin, identifying Augustine as the source of Western society's negative attitudes towards sexuality. Well, Unitarians and Universalists just didn't see it that way. They looked out, and like the God of creation, their response was, "Behold, it is good." The problem rested not so much in the fallen world, but with our blinded eyes. Heaven was right here on earth. Our job was to see it, create it, and take pleasure in it. And far from being indulgent or seductive, this act of pleasure and delighting in the gift of life was the key to humanizing us. Delight has the power to transform us. This is one of the fundamental UU beliefs. Delight can't help but lead to gratitude. Gratitude can't help but lead to generosity. And when you notice that you've been given great gifts, you want to share those gifts and to make others notice them too. For UUs, the tragedy of life is not that unworthiness has cut us off from delight and joy, but that we fail to take the time to reach out and enjoy what is right in front of us. Why is this so hard to do? Could it be that inhibition is bred into our Christian heritage? Could it be that our UU desire to live in our heads makes us fail to trust our instinctive desire to play? It's also a fact that we've been burned as a congregation by too much revelry in the past. Those whose memory of Unitarian Universalism goes back further than mine will recall a time in the heady days of the 60s and the 70s when our denomination got into trouble because some of our clergy and some of our leaders and some of our youth failed to balance revelry with some self-control. Both play and revelry involve a reduction in our inhibitions. In play and in revelry, we are not trying to project an image of correct behavior, and we're not censoring our actions in order to conform with others' ideals. For most of our waking life, when we're not playing, we're keenly aware of what others are thinking of us, and we're making decisions based on how others will perceive us and how our behavior will help us to achieve our goals. In the video we saw earlier, Dr. Stuart Brown talked about play as an altered state of being. So it is with true revelry. We're released from many of our inhibitions. Revelry prepares us for surrender. It increases trust in life. It puts you in a state of openness. It reminds you that it's worth letting go, and that there's something more out there beyond the stiffness of self-protection. So in my extensive research, I looked at many interviews with Mick Jagger over the course of the last few days. And don't get me wrong here, I'm not holding Mick Jagger out as a role model for how to live a good life. But I do find him interesting and insightful at times. And I'm going to grant that he probably knows more about revelry than I ever will. So I was looking for something in those interviews that might provide insight into how Sir Jagger, because he was knighted by the Queen, as you know, how he thought about the pursuit of revelry. He's speaking to younger people, and he may be censoring himself for that reason. But he's asked what's the best party he's ever been to. And you can imagine how many parties Mick Jagger has been to. He refers to the party after his very first wedding back in 1976, I think it was. And he describes it this way. He's describing, he sort of gets a little bit thoughtful and he sort of pieces together what elements would make the best party. He said you need a fantastic mix of people. You need some people that you know well and some strangers, people that you've never met before. You need a balance of men and women. You need a variety of really good music. You need delicious food, but not too much of it. And you need different spaces and rooms so that people can go off to have a private conversation or be in a different kind of environment. So you have more than one room for the party to be conducted in. So when I heard that description, I thought, that's the best party you've ever been to. That's the kind of party I would like. You know, I think Mick Jagger could have been describing her coffee hour. Coffee hour following the service. If we add a little music and maybe a little dancing. Think about it, a fantastic mix of people. Some you know well, and others you don't. A balance of men and women. Now, a variety of really good music is something we have to work on. Delicious food, which we often have, and usually not too much. And different spaces. We've got our wonderful patio in this room, the ballroom. So I'm suggesting that we should start to think about our coffee hour as a great party. A party with our friends and our guests. Wouldn't it be wonderful to know that you're attending a wonderful party every Sunday afternoon after the service? A bit of UU revelry every Sunday afternoon. That's what we do now. We really just don't think about it in those terms. So summer is a time for letting go of responsibility. If you've been working really, really hard, it's time to play. This release from duty is no small thing. Many argue that it's a sacred calling, a needed gift, a gift that we need to give to ourselves. Well, so much for my first sermon on the topic of revelry. I have three simple conclusions. First, I suspect we can all agree that revelry or play should be an important part of each of our lives. And that we each need to find a balance that is just right for us. Second, we can understand revelry and play as good things, as gifts to be appreciated, things to be enjoyed, as part of our theological heritage as Unitarian Universalists. And third, that there is an inevitable tension between our desire for revelry and our inhibitions and the practical need for self-control. I suggest to you that the place of tension where we are most alive, that this is the place where we're most alive, between that tension need to let go and the need to maintain self-control. This is where we'll find the most pleasure and the most meaning in our lives. May it be so.